Here's the thing. I don't think you're actually racist, Lawrence.
Oh, well, that's a relief.
I don't think you're actually racist. Because if you were racist, you wouldn't be sitting here having a conversation with me.
I'd also just... I hate to admit this. Yeah. If I was racist, I'd be proudly racist.
Yeah.
I'd be walking around going, get him out!
Yeah.
You know, because it's just my nature.
Yeah.
I can't lie. For the wrong to rule, the good must just stand idly by. Hello. Recently, I was invited on GB News, as I am from time to time, if I've done something naughty or something good, or just to wind people up generally. And I was on Dubes & Co., I think it was, and I said to Dorbs, who am I on with? And he said, you're on with the Labour councillor, and told me a little bit about, and I went, so I prepared myself for this war of ideas and ideologies, and it was really strange because, as much as we, I'm sure, as we'll find out, we disagree about quite a lot, we managed to have a useful, helpful, free speech based, honest discussion. So, it's my great pleasure to introduce you to Pimana Asad, who is a councillor in Harrow, and she's an Obama. Young, what is it? Obama leader of Europe. But wait, yes. Before we get on that. Okay, so you came to the UK from Afghanistan as a child refugee. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yes, so my parents, well, my dad served in the Afghan army. He's an engineer by profession. The Soviet Union invaded. My dad was taken as a political prisoner because my grandfather was a landowner. And they rounded up the bourgeois class and said that anyone who owns land or disagrees with their political ideology would go to prison. So my grandfather and my dad went to prison. My grandfather was eventually released, but my dad was kept in prison for 5 years by the Soviets. And then after he was released, he switched his sides. He didn't want to serve in the Afghan army alongside the Soviet Union. So he joined the freedom fighters and the rebels, and he went back to his home village where he married my mum and took her with him. And they basically camped out there, basically from village to village, until the Soviet Union left. And a year later, I was born. But Afghanistan went into a really difficult period of time with civil war between the Mujahideen leaders. They were fighting against each other for power. And my parents, my family, there was lots of things happened during that time. My dad was actually taken by religious extremists because he was distributing contraceptive pills in the IDP camps, the internally displaced people camps, because he wanted to control the birth rate in order to be able to help people feed their families. They didn't like that, the extremists didn't like that, and so my dad went missing, and my mom decided that it was time to leave. She was pregnant and she had 3 kids under 5. But prior to that, we had been given political refuge by the UN to go to the United States. My mum didn't want to go to the US. She wanted to come to the UK because she'd heard so many good things about the UK from her friends who had studied here in the 1970s. So when she spent 8 days in Karachi in Pakistan, sorted out the paperwork, got on a flight and landed in London Heathrow, spent the night in London Heathrow. When the immigration officials asked her, where do you want to live? She said, I want to live in London and I want to live in a place called Harun. And they said, Harun, don't think there's a place called Harun. She said, no, look on the map. There is, I know, because my friends told me about this place. And they said, oh, Harrow. And she said, that's it, I want to live there. So that's how my family ended up in Harrow and where I grew up, basically.
I went to school.
Yeah, I can't believe you went to Harrow School.
It's amazing. Obviously, there's something about the area that encourages free and open discourse.
Yes.
So you get to England, you arrive in Harrow.
Yes.
You then, what age are you at this point?
I'm 3 going on 4, yes.
So you're just about, so you're going into reception.
Yes.
So you've started that. So you've been through the entire sort of British education
yes.
system. Where did you go to university?
I went to Brunel.
Right.
And I studied international politics. And then I went to King's College London and did conflict security and development for my master's.
Okay. So and what interests you about politics?
So initially, I actually didn't want to enter. I didn't know anything about British politics. I wasn't really that interested in it. I didn't think that it was a place for someone like me. I actually...
When you say someone like you, what do you mean?
Someone from my kind of background, working class. I grew up on a council estate. My parents were on and off benefits. I just didn't think that it was a place where my voice mattered. It was more rich, elite, you know, well-connected people. I didn't have that.
Hail, stale males.
I didn't know. No, well, no, I'm just saying very well-connected, very wealthy people. I didn't see myself as part of that group. And so I just didn't think. And also, nobody had ever told me, you can join a political party, you can be a member, you can get active. That was never told to me. So my initial dream was to work in the charity sector and travel and go abroad and work mostly in Afghanistan. Because I thought, you know, I've got an education now in order to give back sort of thing to other people who aren't as privileged as myself. But my mum was completely against that. She threw a whole fit of this.
What was she?
Well, she nearly threw herself out of the car when I was driving, and I told her that I got a job with an NGO in Kabul. She threw a whole fit and she said, "I'm going to kill myself if you go." All of this kind of stuff.
But she's probably got a good reason. Yeah, it sounds like, you know, moving from village to village.
Yeah,
raiding
she
warlords
said. Yeah,
doesn't
well,
sound fun.
Exactly. She said to me, "I took you out of the fire and you want to go back into that fire. I don't want you to do that. I sacrificed everything to get you here. Why would you want to go back?" And so for the next 6 months, I was sort of like depressed and at home, refusing to find a job, just throwing a tantrum like you do when you're newly graduated.
I'm still throwing tantrums. I'm 44. Worrying.
So I said, I refused to find a job, refused to do that. And then I started doing some volunteering in Harrow with a local charity, helping single mums access local government services. So what I was doing was really filling out their forms for like housing or helping them get benefits or whatever. And there was this one case of this woman who came in. She was pregnant. She couldn't speak any English. Her husband was a chronic gambler, and the council was refusing to help them. And just trying to help her and go through that whole process made me I saw my mum in her, because I thought if that was my mum and nobody was trying to help her, she would have ended up on the street. And in the end, I had to step in, get a guarantor for her, get a home for her, put her in, get her settled down. And then I thought, right, who's responsible for this?
And who was it?
And the Tories ran the council at the time.
It's the Tories' fault time!
And I was like, well, clearly there's something wrong with the Conservative Party because they refused to help this woman.
Yeah.
So I need to look around me and see. I mean, I'd always naturally felt that I was Labour, but I was not a card-holding member.
Is that do you feel your Labour as sort of class Labour, if you know what I mean?
Yeah.
For me, the Labour Party was always meant to represent vulnerable people, the working classes, making sure that they are protected, because, you know, they're the lifeblood of any society. So that's what I thought Labour was. That's why it's weird to actually meet someone who is Labour. Anyway, sorry, carry on.
No, that's originally the reason why I was naturally sort of inclined to be a Labour supporter. When I turned 18, I voted Labour for the first time too. But I had never really thought of being a card-holding member of it. And then when I looked into Labour's history of the NHS, of working class, you know, the trade unions building the Labour Party and all of this kind of stuff, that really resonated with me. It's about people who, basically poor people who came together to try and fight for their rights and get political representation to try and help each other. And I thought that collective action, that kind of thing spoke to me, being part of a team trying to better society. And so I joined the Labour Party and started campaigning with them. And I stood for election for the first time in 2014, but I lost to the Tory candidates, obviously.
Very Tory, Harrow.
But we managed to switch control of the council from Tory to Labour. And I thought, well, that's one good thing.
Yeah.
And then 4 years later, I stood again. I kept continuing to campaign with the Labour Party, and then I got elected in 2018.
It's amazing. So can I ask you, it would seem, as much as it was really difficult, you know, there's lots of stories of people arriving in England with a suitcase and £5 and, you know, making something of life. It would seem, speaking to you, that your arrival from Afghanistan into the UK and your assimilation into the UK and now the fact that you're holding political office in the UK would symbolise to me that England is quite a warm and welcoming country. Do you feel England is a warm, welcoming country, or do you think, are you on the side of the fact that Britain is a systemically racist hellhole and we hate all immigrants of all kinds, or is it somewhere in the middle?
So I think that it's somewhere in the middle. I don't think that you know, I can hold two ideals at the same time. I can say that there are institutions in the UK that are racist and have huge problems with the way that they act and the way that they treat police. People, the police mainly, specifically. And then on the other side, I can say that the people of the United Kingdom are so much better than its government, and that they're not racist, and that they're welcoming, that they're open. Because I know, because I've been to these communities, I've knocked on these doors, I've spoken to these people. I know deep down in everyone's heart that the UK is a hugely welcoming and amazing place. And I wouldn't have chosen anywhere else. I think my mum made the right decision to come to the UK and not go to the US.
Especially now.
I always say that to her. Like, I'm very thankful. I'm like, the UK, you know, when you come back to London after a holiday or something, or the UK, you're just like, our home, you know?
Yeah.
And that's how I feel about the UK, because I love it. And when I was in when I was traveling always, specifically in Afghanistan, and someone would say something bad about the UK, I'd feel really angry and want to defend the UK and be like, no. X, Y, and Z.
So would you describe yourself as a British
I would describe myself as a British Afghan, yeah.
Right, okay.
Because I think that my Afghan identity will never escape me. When you look at me, you'll know that I'm not white English.
Like Bjorn here.
Well, you just know that I'm not. And then some people will treat me differently because of the way that I look or my name or my religion or whatever it is. But there will be a majority of people who will just be like, yeah, okay, what do we have in common and how can we be friends and work together? And I think the biggest example of that is what we saw with last year, the Afghan evacuation and the way that the UK reacted to that. People in the UK reacted to that. I'm not saying the government, the people of the UK.
So just before we started filming, you said, yeah, I was in Afghanistan last year. I got evacuated by the RAF. Do you want to tell us a bit about that?
It's a really, really long story.
It's not funny,
it's not funny at all. It's not, but you either laugh or you cry, and I choose to laugh about it rather than cry about it, because it's a very traumatic experience. You know, I was out there visiting my family. My dad actually packed up and left the UK in 2001, straight after the Americans invaded, because he never really felt like...
So he was there once the Americans invaded after 9/11?
So he went back, yeah, after they rid of the Taliban, he went back in 2001.
What is one of Afghanistan's biggest commodities that the West steal, other than opium?
Coal, there's oil. Mm. These are untapped reserves of oil and various other minerals, that gems, diamonds, that kind of stuff.
So, was the experiment a noble experiment to go, what we'll do is we'll take a country with, as you said, a vastly different cultural heritage, and we will put the Western democratic model on it to see if that works? Because there is quite a famous picture of the pride flag flying over Kabul University just not long before the whole thing went to hell. So do you think it's a noble experiment to try and bring for the West to try and export democracy to different cultures or not?
My grandfather was the first democratically elected mayor of Zabul province in Afghanistan, through the constitutional reforms that the last king made in the 1960s. So Afghanistan has always experimented with democracy itself. I mean, you could see that through the rise of communism and then, you know, democratic forces in the 1960s. So Afghanistan has always experimented with this. So it's not that the West has gone there and said, hey, here's a bit of democracy, have it.
Yeah.
Afghans have always wanted, but they've always experimented with it between what their culture says and what, you know, the political spheres of thought and influence have. So I don't think it's about... I think what the West got wrong when they went into Afghanistan is they said, oh, okay, you want this person to be your leader? Because they did the Bonn Conference in 2001, where they brought all these Afghans together. They didn't invite the Taliban, which was wrong, I think. And second, the Afghans said, hey, we want the king, the last king of Afghanistan, to be our monarch. We want the king to return because it's a unifying figure.
Yeah.
And America said no.
Why did America say no to that? Because you would have thought a king, that sort of that model, that monarchic model, is...
Because America is a republic and they don't have a monarchy.
Yeah.
And they thought, no, we want you to have more of a presidential system, so no king. They said, okay, fine, you don't want us to have a king, we want this guy to be our leader. Abdul Sattar Sirat is his name. He was an ethnic Uzbek, but a lot of Afghans really supported him and said, this guy can take us forward in this interim administration. And the US said, no, we don't want him. We want this other guy called Hamid Karzai, and he's going to be your interim president. And then you'll have elections, and we'll see what happens. And so that, you know, changing the whole Afghans want this, but we're actually telling you, you're going to have this. That is where we went wrong right from the start.
Okay.
And then interfering in political appointments as governors, you know, who's going to be an MP, who's going to be a minister in government. That kind of interference in the Afghan state didn't help. But the biggest culprit here is Pakistan.
So I didn't know about the Anglo-Afghan War. So this is why, you know, in terms of stuff like history being taught in school, I think that would be, it is really interesting.
Yeah.
In terms of education, when you were educated in England, did you find that the teaching of history, for example, was fair and equitable and on and sort of representative of your experience?
I never really thought about it being representative. I just thought, this is the history that we're being taught. We're being taught about the
biggest Hundred Years War and stuff.
Yeah,
like that.
We're being taught about World War One, World War Two mainly, and a little bit about the Soviet War in Afghanistan, the Cold War, the Cuban Missile Crisis, those kinds of big world events. I didn't really think anything about of it being inclusive or any of that. That didn't really cross my mind. When I think about it now, I think that we're not taught enough about history and its actual context in terms of, we were never taught about the British Empire. The only thing we were ever taught is that the sun never set on the Union flag, you know, that kind of stuff. So we weren't
Did the British
really
Empire do anything good?
Sorry?
Did the British Empire do anything good?
Well, exported English language, I guess.
And law, equality under the law.
I don't think so. I think that they're, so if we're talking about South Asia, let's talk about the places that Afghanistan says it belongs to it. So the border between Afghanistan and Pakistan is called the Durand Line. Afghanistan does not recognise that as an international border. Across the Durand Line, you've got the Waziristan, it's a province in modern-day Pakistan right now. It's still governed by the laws that the British Empire set back when Britain was ruling over those areas.
Is it peaceful?
No.
No.
It's still being governed by colonial era laws. Therefore, that means that the state of Pakistan and the military are allowed to racially profile someone and imprison them illegally without them doing anything wrong. There are certain laws that discriminate against the local populace, because obviously if you're an empire, you want to control the local population, and you want to, anybody who is against your kind of rule, you want to stop them from, you know, getting support from the local population. So you'd imprison them, you wouldn't, you know, give them their rights. And that kind of stuff, that law, for example, still is prevalent in that part of the world. So there are legacies of the empire that still exist. But, you know, I think the most powerful thing that the British Empire did was probably the spreading of the English language. And that's why me and you are speaking English now. And when I go to Europe, I speak English with a lot of people. So, you know.
So that's, it's just fascinating. Okay, right. I want to go on to the modern Labour Party.
Okay.
So you spoke passionately about why you joined the Labour Party and what you feel the Labour Party represents. Do you think that the modern Labour Party is representative of those initial ideals that drew you towards it?
I think the Labour Party struggles with representing working class values and working class people. I think that those who represent our party sometimes don't come from those backgrounds, and so therefore struggle to understand what it's like to come from that kind of background. Most people on both sides of the house, if you look at all political parties, are Eton or Oxbridge educated. Most of them sometimes do have wealthy families behind them. And so it's really difficult. I think the Labour Party struggles, if I'm going to be honest.
And in terms of stuff like identity politics, so now in 2022, you know, someone said to me the other day, no one would have predicted the fact that when Twitter began, that one of the tweets that would hit 10 years later that would cause great problems was the description of what a woman is. And Labour do have a problem with explaining what a woman is. Do you know what a woman is?
Yes, a woman is the person with a vagina.
Right,
yes. Excellent. And a man is someone with a penis, yes.
Oh my God. Ladies and gentlemen, next leader of the Labour Party, please. Why does Keir Starmer have trouble explaining it?
Because I think that there are elements within the Labour Party who feel that using that kind of language is discriminatory to trans people and to people who might not, you know, have that. But I think that we need to just be, you know, sex is a fact, you know, that is there.
Oh my God, she's done it again. Biology.
Sex is a fact. But we also need to be very inclusive and aware that there are people who are trans.
Stop right there.
That there are people who
inclusive.
Are trans. Inclusive. Yes, inclusive.
Right. Here's my theory. I'm hitting you with my theory.
Okay, go on.
I think that this woke thing is pretends to talk about inclusivity, diversity, equitable. Okay. All of that stuff. I think it pretends it, and it uses minority groups to get its political agenda on across. But I think ultimately what it is a desire for kind of communism, especially the equity aspect of it, which is that we should have equal outcomes for everybody. Where do you sit on that? Do you think everyone should have an equal outcome, or do you believe in a meritocratic world where there is that we should have equality of opportunity?
I think we should definitely have equality of opportunity, but the reality is that most people don't have equality of opportunity.
Yeah.
That is just a fact, that sometimes some people stay ahead of the line and some people are the back of the line based on things that are out of their control.
Like their birth.
Their birth. Like, for example, let me give you an example.
But look at you. I mean,
I wasn't essentially born here.
No, but I'm just saying, for someone who's fleeing warlords, you seem to have done all right.
I mean, I did, but remember, I come from a quite privileged background. My parents are educated. My dad had a job even during that very difficult wartime period.
Your granddad was in jail for 5 years. It just doesn't sound very privileged to me.
No, but here's the thing, though. I can see where the privileged points are, where I can compare myself to another Afghan who might not have had that. Right. Do you know what I mean? And I know that I'm, because of my access to the fact that my parents were educated, they had networks, they were able to find
get to Haroon.
Yeah, to get to Haroon. Yeah, exactly. The fact that they were able to do that makes them more privileged than other Afghans who weren't able to.
You're making a good point about privilege.
Yeah.
So one of the things that got me into trouble, you said I'm not cancelled, but I am cancelled from doing acting.
I don't think you are with this office, come on.
But all I'm saying is, where I believe in privilege,
100%.
I was very, very privileged. And
you went to Harrow School.
And I went to Harrow School. And I'm fully acknowledged that I'm very privileged. But I also meet people who have come from nothing.
Yeah.
And when I was at acting school, it was never the people who come from nothing who would criticise me for being, you know, my dad was an actor.
Yeah.
It was kind of an easy shoo-in for me. You've still got to be a good actor, but, it did me no harm.
Yeah.
It was never the working class brickie, former brickie from Liverpool. He'd be like, good on you, mate. Yeah, fucking great.
Yeah.
It was always the middle class girl from Putney who was like, you're privileged. So I was thinking, do you think... Okay, two questions. One... is privilege class-based? And two, do you think it's helpful to talk about concepts like skin colour privilege? Like this concept is very, what I think is a very divisive concept of what they call white privilege.
I mean, I think this privilege is very complex, right? So if you look at me, for example, I grew up on a council estate. My parents were on and off benefits. My parents weren't educated in the British education system. They didn't know how to navigate this. They don't have networks here. I had to navigate all of that by myself. You know, there are other people in the UK whose parents are lords or MPs and help them navigate these systems of privilege, and they get to that place. So I think that is really complex. What I think that is really important, you know, in my first job, for example, I never thought of people as the Muslim community or the black community, or I never thought of people like that before I entered politics. When I entered politics, everyone was in a box.
That's fascinating.
Everyone, and I was like, wow. I was really shocked. I was like, wow.
What box were you in?
I was in the Muslim community box, even though I didn't really identify as, like, you know, that wasn't the thing that identified me. I just found it fascinating that politicians put people in these boxes and then expect you to act like those boxes.
Which to me feels like, but that it feels like, so I have this major problem with the whole, you know, certainly in terms of the race stuff, when it's like, you know, you have white privilege, so therefore you have to really look after the poor black people. It feels sort of racist in reverse to me. It's like, as a person of colour, that you don't have opportunities to succeed in this world and that white people need to step aside or whatever it is.
Well, I don't think
the boards of all these companies are all white anyway. So I'm like, why don't you step aside?
Well, that's a very good point. I think that when you look at businesses and organisations across the UK, the majority of the senior leadership is white.
Which we are an 80%. Well,
yes, exactly. But that is natural when you have a population of more than 80% white, right? Yeah. But where it, you know, it's proven that if you have a diverse and inclusive workforce, your profitability increases.
When you talk about diverse and inclusive, what does that mean?
That means women, that means people of colour, that means all kinds of
genders
and whatever.
Look at our football team. I'm with you up to gender. Because gender doesn't exist.
Oh my God.
But look at our football team. It couldn't be any more diverse and inclusive if it tried. In actual fact, you know, if we were to have diversity, equity, and inclusion in part of this football team, there would only be two players of colour in it.
But you need to look at it. So if you had, for example, Lawrence Fox, the England footballer player, right?
He was great.
Yes, right. And he came from a privileged background. His dad was wealthy. He went to Harrow School, all the rest of it. Mm. And he got extra lessons for football, got a private coach, all the rest of it. So he got a head start. Then you have, I don't know, Adam from
Golders Green.
Yeah, Golders Green, who's black, for example. Yeah. Grew up in a council estate. Family didn't have much money.
I like
didn't
have great assassin.
didn't have access to a private coach.
Yeah,
all of that kind of stuff. So he's starting at the back of the line, but Lawrence is ahead, right?
Yeah, but he's got something that Lawrence doesn't have.
Which is
drive, determination, and much.
How
more
do you
grip.
Know Lawrence doesn't have that?
Because
both of them
Lawrence,
obviously have it.
Lawrence has not had to travel through tribal warlands to get to play football for England, you know. So what I'm saying is, I think there's a fortitude that comes with suffering. Now, I believe that everybody can suffer. Everybody.
Yeah. Yes, I agree that everyone can suffer.
Yeah.
I agree completely. But what I'm saying is that Lawrence hasn't had the same difficulties as Adam has, right? No.
But that's life, right?
But that is where the privilege comes in. So I think privilege is mixed. I don't think privilege is just about race, because I think white working class kids
struggle.
From council estates struggle. And I've seen it myself. On my estate, for example, all of us were of the mindset, we've got to make it in life so we can get out of the estate and we can actually help our parents.
Yeah.
That was it. Whether you were black, whether you were white, whether you were Asian, whatever you were, that was the mentality on our estate. And we worked damn hard, and most of us have been able to do that now. So I feel really proud of that, of people like that. So I think that it's complex. Privilege is complex. It's not just a mix of, it's not just about race. It's about class. It's about access to networks. It's about your family background as well.
So as far as countries go, do you think Britain is doing its best to have that?
Yes, I think Britain is trying its best, but I think that we should be better at it. That's all. In certain places, in certain institutions.
We all would like to be better. Okay, which institution bothers you the most?
Well, right now, the police.
Why?
Because...
Bothers me too, you may have noticed.
Well, one, because they don't do their job, and two, because of the way that they've acted over certain situations. Like, for example, Sarah Everard.
Yeah.
The way that they reacted to that wasn't right.
In what way? Because of the WhatsApp messages? Because this stuff should have been spotted earlier?
How can you have a serving police officer who's known as being a rapist, you know, and then allow him to go out on the street and do that?
Yeah.
You know, the police are there to protect us. I'm not of the thought that we shouldn't have police. I'm a local councillor. I know how important police are.
Yeah.
And I think police should be properly funded, properly trained, you know, to have the resources to actually protect communities. against organised crime. Sometimes in our communities, people think that the police are in on it.
Really?
There are communities there are in the UK be bad that think that.
There are going to be bad apples. There are councils in the UK where they're all in on it. So corruption is everywhere.
Yeah.
But the police, I've noticed a change in the police, because I think we used to have, you know, the sort of the England of yesteryear, the less diverse and inclusive and equitable one. There was Dixon of Dock Green, who was the famous policeman, and, you know, he was like, you'd go up to him if there was a problem. But now we've seen that the police are more of a, they sort of seem to be more of a political thing, which brings me on to gender and pride.
Okay.
What do you support the progressive pride flag? Do you support? Would you say that if a child feels that they're born in the wrong body, that they should be allowed puberty blockers?
Or? I think that if a child feels that way, they should be given the support to be able to investigate that and get the mental health support specifically to navigate that situation. Because obviously, I've read cases where people have been given puberty blockers and then later on in life said that that was the wrong decision for them.
Mm.
And so I think these issues are really complex. And I think that, you know, where we have children who feel like that, they should be supported and helped.
Do you not think they're just going to turn it? The fraction of people.
I don't know, because if you look at it,
it's a fraction. It's a fraction. It's something like 0.3% of the population are trans.
So then why are you obsessing over it?
Because I don't think it's got anything to do with trans people.
So what do you think it has?
I think what happens is this little woke movement, which wants to shut up freedom of speech and tell you exactly what you are allowed to say and not allowed to say, which is suppression of freedom of speech, the only way it gets traction is by jumping on minority groups. So I think Black Lives Matter was an example of it. Black Lives Matter was an openly Marxist organisation until they disagree with that.
Yeah, but until completely.
It amended its website. It called for the end of the nuclear family. That's openly Marxist. Mm. And also Build a Large Mansion. Sorry, Black Lives Matter. The woman who started it has now got 4 mansions in Topanga Canyon with all the white people.
Is it a bit of a grift
or is it complex?
I think activism is very complex. You know, sometimes you have people who are project based. They do it specifically for the money and for the fame and, you know, to make a name for themselves and to get the 4 mansions or whatever it is.
Yeah.
Other people are actually committed to actually making changes in society, because the truth is that Black people do have a disadvantage in society, whether you like to admit
it
or not.
But so do white people.
They are 10 times or 9 times more likely to be stopped by police just because of the way that they look, just because they're driving a car, just because of all that stuff. But you're not, though. If you were in a car, Lawrence, would you get stopped by the police?
I've been stopped by the police repeatedly.
I've been stopped by the police too.
But what I'm saying is, if I was in charge of the police, for example, the Met Police, say I was in charge of the Met Police, I'd say I want every single youth between the ages of 13 and 18 stopped and searched in London. I want them, every single person, to know. Because I want
that
every child...
What? For what
because
reason?
I want every
madness!
Let me just tell you why. Don't tell me it's madness before I've explained my reason.
Go on.
You've got to let me explain my reason. I would like to know, a child, a young person to know, that at some point in their life, a policeman is going to stop them and say, what have you got in your pockets? So I think that would deter people who would frequently carry a knife in their pocket from thinking, do I want to spend a long period of time in jails? Now, look,
that it does deter people, though.
No,
because... Doing that kind of stuff, stopping and searching doesn't deter. It actually aggravates people in the community. They feel like they're being, you know, the police are purposely going after them.
But we've already agreed that, that white working class kids have a really...
Yeah, they have a hard time, and they have the same kind of struggles that I did.
So it's a class thing, not a skin colour thing.
Well, I think that
it's complex.
Here's the thing: I think it's very complex, right? So, I was in a job once. I won't say what it was, but it was me and another working class white woman, and the way she was treated by our boss was horrendous. But because of her accent and because of where she came, like where she grew up, she didn't grow up in London. But I was also working class, but because I sound like this, I was treated differently.
Right.
So I saw the way she was treated, and I said to her, hey, that's not right, like we need to do something
about this.
Is that
not just human nature?
Sometimes I think it is human nature, but sometimes I think people...
Actively discriminate.
And
you think the police do that?
Huh?
You think the police do that?
Yes, I do. I think that there is...
But they're all saying they're anti-racist police forces.
Well, you can say that you're anti-racist, but doesn't mean that you are.
Well, I
the Labour Party says it's anti-racist. Is it always anti-racist?
The Labour Party's always had a slight problem with anti-Semitism. Let's be honest.
Yeah, and...
On that subject, quickly. Yes. Why does everyone in the Labour Party really care about Palestine?
Why does everyone in the... Well, I don't think everyone in the Labour Party really cares, but there's certain sections of the Labour Party.
When you see, like, Labour Party MPs and stuff, you get the little red rose and then you get the Palestine flag. And there's lots of American Democrat politicians do the same on the left. What is the thing about that? Because surely, if you've come from Afghanistan to England, you've migrated here, then what's happened is Jews have gone to Israel.
Yes.
So we're sort of pro-migration, right? So what's the Palestine thing?
So I think that sometimes people... I'm not going to be very popular saying this, but...
It's all right.
I think sometimes people use the Palestine issue as a way to say that they care about a cause that...
Virtue signalling.
Yes. I think that sometimes it's a PR exercise for certain people.
Mm.
And I think that actual Palestinians and actual Palestinian voices... they want to sit down with Israelis and actually have conversations of how to come to a compromise and create peace between Israel and Palestine. And I think that certain people hijack these situations to benefit themselves. And I think there is an unhealthy and weird obsession with the Palestine-Israel issue because there are so many other conflicts around the world, so many other issues going on. For example, the Uyghurs in China, you know, in concentration camps, because of their religion.
Building our iPhones.
Well, you know, there's lots of things like that happening across the world, and yet we don't obsessively talk about them, but
Why do we talk about...
I think that...
Because Labour Party quite likes communism?
No, I don't think it's to do with
that. I mean, I'm just asking.
No, I genuinely think it's because, you know, they see the Palestinians as, you know, people who have something unjust done to them, and therefore the whole Labour thing is to support people who are... you know, who need justice and who need someone to fight on their behalf. And so there's that. But there also is this weird obsession with the state of Israel. And, you know, people feel like Israel shouldn't exist and the whole empire and colonial aspect of Britain's involvement in that.
Hang on a minute.
So
is it our fault then?
Well, you know, everywhere you have these conflicts, it has something to do with the British Empire. So you want to wonder why.
I know, but we built really nice railways.
Yeah, not in Afghanistan.
No, it's too... Well, it's a bit hilly.
Not everywhere.
It's a
not all places are hilly in Afghanistan. Come on now.
It's quite hilly in the bits up there. It's a bit flatter down there. We should have built more railways.
Mm.
If I could go back in time, I'd get the lads onto it.
Yeah.
But, right, so we've noticed a change in the British voting intentions. I want to ask you two more things. First of all... I'll do this one first, actually. Do you believe in free speech?
Yes.
Right. To what level? Do you think
I think we need to be respectful of other people.
Right.
And I don't believe in the word tolerance, because I think...
You don't believe in the word tolerance?
No, because if you are trying to tolerate something, that means that you don't really want it there, and you're just having to forcefully accept that it's there.
So you think there's a pejorative in tolerance?
I think that we need to be respectful. I grew up on the notion of on this value of respect.
But that
right?
respect is subjective. Tolerance is objective.
Well, how do you mean?
Well, tolerance is like just you said. It's like you. So my theory, I do like the word tolerance.
You like the word. I don't like that word.
No, but it's fine. Yeah. It's fine for us to disagree. I think we should be tolerant of everything except intolerance.
Mm.
So that's what I would say of you. Mm. But when you say we should be respectful, I go, who gets to decide what's respectful? It's a subjective term.
Mm.
Whereas tolerance is like, this is it. That's you, whether you like it or not, which is what you picked up on. But you've almost, it's almost like you're feeling it as a pejorative where it's more.
No, I think we need to switch it. And I think we need to think about it differently. I think that people need to stop fearing one another and stop feeling like, oh, this person's out to, like, you know, take over my country or take over my culture or, like, get rid of the English. Like, no, that's not the case. What we need to understand is that we have way more in common with each other than we have in differences, but our differences should be celebrated too.
Yeah.
You know, that's why I'm sitting here with you.
Yeah.
And having this conversation and not running away and being like, hey, Lawrence Fox is a mad guy, you know?
Well, I am a little bit mad.
Okay. Yeah, I know by some of the things you do, but having read about some of the things that you've said and then sometimes apologized for, I can understand that you do understand respect. You do understand that there is a need to actually think about what you've said and whether you've hurt people's feelings.
I'm
actually
quite provocative, because what I do is I go, I forget to say the bit that I need to say first.
So the context part.
The beginning bit, like you have to say, of course we have to love, honour and actually I would say respect, but tolerate, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Our gay and lesbian and trans brothers and sisters, of course we do. But I sort of miss that bit out and go, don't do it to children. So that's where my weakness is. So good. So you're pro free speech.
Yes.
Okay. So Labour obviously has had a pretty bad showing in 2019.
Mm-hmm.
Right. How are they going to win their voters back? And what's your feeling of the party? Do you think the party's going in the right direction? What would you do if you were appealing to a... So, because I think a lot of people who watch this would be naturally Labour voters who've turned Tory for that election. So what would you say to them as what your sense of the party is and what you would like to see Labour Party be moving forward?
I want the Labour Party to actually represent communities up and down the UK and actually have people who understand those communities and what it's like to actually grow up in those communities. And what I want to see the Labour Party do is actually appeal to people's everyday lives and actually have policies that fix people's everyday lives and stop obsessing over things that make no difference, you know?
Yeah.
And just focus on the bread and butter issues, especially in the UK, but also realise the immense power and responsibility that we have. I want us to appeal, but sometimes I feel like no matter what the Labour Party does, people will just always see us as this evil, you know.
No, but you don't come across evil at all. You come across as really pretty sensible to me.
But I want people
Except for your gender stuff and their colonial stuff. I really like the colonial. Not the empire, sweetheart. All right.
I want people to keep an open mind and not just think, oh, if someone's Labour, that's it. You know, they write them off. I want them to actually have an open mind and say, okay, what can I find that I agree with? And the parts that I don't agree with, how can I change that?
Why are you not like an MP? Are you going to be an MP?
Well, I stood in 2019, I wasn't elected, but I think that there's something about the establishment in this country or people who are, I don't know, maybe I'm too outspoken, maybe it's because I'm sitting with Lawrence Fox on a podcast. I don't know, maybe it's because I reach out to people and I'm not scared of having these conversations.
Yeah.
I don't know, maybe that's what people are scared of in the Labour Party.
That's what you want. You want brave people who stand up and are not willing and are not frightened of engaging with what is, you know, I don't really believe in other sides, as you say, I'm with you. We've got more in common than not, and we shouldn't demonise each other. Mm. But that's common sense. I think that would appeal to a...
I don't know why. I mean, you'd have to ask people who run the Labour Party about why sometimes they don't put people in who would challenge the system and try and change things in a positive way. I think that the Labour Party's too scared sometimes to be who it really wants to be.
Right. What's your ambition? Because it would seem to me like if you were sat in speaking on the Labour benches instead of Keir Starmer, for example, who is, you know, got a total personality bypass and obviously can't describe what a woman is, would you be, if someone said to you, you know, do you have the ambition to go?
I would love to be an MP. I think it would be an honour to represent the UK, especially, but communities in the UK, to try and make things better, because I don't think that the whole reason of getting involved in politics in the first place is because I didn't see anybody there who was fighting for what I believed in and what I wanted for my community. I saw massive cuts in my community. I saw people really struggling and I thought I need to be at that table to fight for those who can't. And I don't see that sometimes across both sides of the house, and that's really difficult. But then there are really good people trying. And I think that people should keep an open mind when it comes to the Labour Party and try and find people they actually agree with and try and find things that they can agree with. Because it's a fact that the media in this country hasn't exactly been pro-Labour.
Sorry, did you just say that out loud?
Yes.
And meant it?
Yes.
Okay.
It's the truth that, you know, if you look at the way that
to be fair, you are, in a way you're right, but Labour hardly did themselves any favours, you know, really.
But what do you mean by that? No matter what leader we have, nobody's happy. Everyone always wants us to change our leader, no matter who it is.
I reckon there's someone like Ed Miliband. I mean, if they'd had David Miliband, they'd have half the chance.
True.
You know? Not like Ed Miliband is. But I bet you
they would find something about David Miliband to also beat him with and say, you know.
Tony Blair was very, very popular and charismatic.
Yes, true.
And, you know.
But that's a once in a lifetime sort of, you know.
Yeah, but it might be your lifetime.
I don't know.
I reckon you should go at it, because then actually you would have. Conservatives have something to argue with, rather than just spitting at each other across the floor, these sort of crappy insults.
I mean, I'd love to, but it's really difficult.
Vote her in. So you deny that I've been cancelled.
Yes, I deny you've been cancelled.
But we've got something else in common. So I haven't been cancelled. Right, have you been cancelled ever?
Well, in 2019, this account called Nasha Jew, on Twitter, was exposing anti-Semitism in the Labour
this
Party.
Is your joke. I've read about this. This is when you would go gassed.
Yes.
Which is street language for funny or bad or whatever.
Exactly. And it was a tweet about me meeting someone, a man who asked me if I was Israeli, and I said no. And I said to him, you know, I said I told him a joke about me being part of the 10 lost tribes of Israel, like Afghans being one of the 10 lost tribes of Israel. And he got really excited. But instead of saying excited, I used the word gassed in my tweet. And Nasha Jew said, what does this mean? Are you saying all Jews should be gassed? And obviously I was a Labour Party candidate at the time, standing to be an MP in Ruislip, Northwood and Pinner. And when I saw that, I was like, my heart sank, because I was like, that's not what it means. But also, I felt so bad. You know, I've never spoken to anyone about this, by the way. I've never given any interviews or
can find offence anyway. Yeah, how did it make you feel?
It made me feel like, I was like, okay, that's definitely not what I meant. And I would never, ever say anything like that in my life. And I just felt, why can't people see the context of what I'm saying? I was actually saying a really nice thing.
Yeah.
What I was saying was, I found it as a compliment that someone would say I was Israeli, because at the time in Harrow there was lots of Israeli women selling like things.
Yeah,
they had small pop-up shops and they were selling stuff, and they were really beautiful. So I was like, oh wow, this person thinks I'm Israeli. That's a compliment.
Yeah.
But
you'd have to be a very bad faith actor to go like. Sometimes look for, and I'm going to put my hands up to it, when you're saying, you know, you're never happy with whoever chooses a Labour Party leader. You'd have to act in pretty bad faith to go to not understand the context of that.
But I think there was.
I thought your statement was good.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I provided screenshots and, you know, evidence of why how I've used that word before and why I used it. But I apologise because of the feelings aspect, because people's feelings were hurt and they thought that I had used it in a different context, which I hadn't. So, you know, I was getting abuse for 3-4 days straight, and I had to deactivate my Twitter account.
Whoosh.
Because the abuse was just so bad.
You have days where you don't get abuse on Twitter.
No.
You should go through my hellfire of Twitter. All of my hellfire of Twitter is just, I don't bother reading it anymore.
But I just felt like the reason why some people came after me was not because they understood the context, they understood how I said it, but because of what I represented and who I am. And that's the reason why they decided they wanted to cancel me. Because I was Labour, because I was a woman, because I was a Muslim, because I was a person of colour.
But then you're saying that...
I genuinely do think that there were certain people...
You're saying that this... You can't on the one hand say that this country, like the people of this country, are really warm, tolerant and not
they
racist.
They are. I can hold those two ideals at the same time.
So
there's
a small activist group of right-wingers who have sort of, you know... In any society, you've got nasty...
Yeah, online, anonymous, you don't know who they are. They say all sorts of things, and people associate them with certain groups.
So did you think that was it? Game over, then?
I thought, oh, that's it. It's over for me. But...
Did you think it affected the election?
In some ways, yeah, I was shouted at in the street by people that I had read it.
No one should be shouted at in the street.
I was shouted in the street, but then I went to this local synagogue for a hustings straight after that.
Okay.
And I gave a speech to the synagogue about my upbringing and how my dad always said to me when I was growing up, don't believe other Muslims when they say that Israel doesn't have a right to exist. It does. Don't believe that. That's propaganda. And think of it in a different way. Everyone has a right to exist. And I said, okay. So I always had that at the back of my mind when I was confronted with these issues. So I was able to go to the synagogue, do that speech. And
how was it received?
Very warmly. Yeah. And I think my local community really understood. And I think that's the difference between online and in person,
yeah,
where you can have these conversations and explain and come to an understanding, whereas online it's they see one statement and they say that's it, you know.
See, I decided to take completely the opposite approach to you, okay, which is standard. So when I went on Question Time and this woman said you're a white privileged male, I said, yes, that's racist, and then I left and I was like, I'm not going to apologise.
Okay.
Because I think it is racist to call someone a privileged white male. I think to bring immutability into anything is particularly racist. And my strategy has also had its ups and downs as a result of it. But I think it's wrong, generally wrong, to deliberately, in bad faith, turn around and say, because you're so blatantly not anti-Semitic or racist, or... and representative of any of the front bench of the Labour Party.
You know, here's the thing. I don't think you're actually racist, Lawrence.
Well, that's a relief.
I don't think you're actually racist, because if you were racist, you wouldn't be sitting here having a conversation with me.
I'd also just, I hate to admit this, if I was racist, I'd be proudly racist.
Yeah.
I'd be walking around going, get him out!
Yeah.
You know, because it's just my nature.
Yeah.
I can't lie. Yeah.
So I don't think that you're racist. I just think that some of the things you say are hugely problematic, and I disagree with you.
But they're deliberate. I do it deliberately, because it's how you spark a conversation.
Yeah.
If you say some things, certain things, you get people talking, and that's all I ever really want, is people to be talking. Now, if, you know, people accuse me of being a racist, and that's fine. And actually, you know what? Because I believe in free speech, I think that people have the right to hold the opinion that I'm a racist. I think you're, but what you're not allowed to do is to say that I am categorically a racist and defend it as a statement of truth. Because that, it's still in this country, which is a warm and welcoming and tolerant country, it really is, that still holds such a huge, you know, amount of emotional weight.
Of course. Nobody wants to be told that you actively discriminate against someone else.
Yeah.
Just based on their colours.
Yeah. Or whether they're gay or straight or anything.
Yeah.
Immutable stuff. I can't. Well, that's nice. I'm not a racist, which is a relief. It's been an absolute honour and a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you for taking time to do it.